Politica Culturali, miaj Karsten Schwierig. Sellem l-semija ta' Campus FM għal dil sensiela ġdida fl-iskeda tal-istazzjon ta' radio li sema l-politika kulturali fija nixtieq nesplora ftit aspetti marbutin ma' dit-tema tal-politika kulturali li forsi meta jismagħha bniedem jgħid mhux forsi l-iktar ħaġa ma nafx eċitanti jew li ħadd iġbidni biex nisma' dwarha kemm il-kelma politika issa l-numru ta' snin assoċjaw affarijiet governattivi, ta' tmexxija, burokratiċi, jew inkella biex jattirawna l-attenzjoni kważi kważi jridu jkun offerti tal-aħbarijiet u ta' ġrajiet kurrenti. Mill-banda l-oħra kulturali terminu wiesa ħafna, l-studios minn Wales Raymond Williams kien jgħid li fil-lingwa Ingliża kelma kultura hija waħda mill-iktar komplikati. U nafu wkoll mitoloġikament kif l-għajdutu li Goebbels tar-reġim ta' Nazi ta' Hitler kien jgħid li meta jisma' kelma kultura kien ifittex jiġbor ir-revolver. Għaliex kienet kelma li tirrabja ħafna. Aħna ħaniprovaw ma mmurux dawn l-estremitajiet, imma permezz tal-mistiedna tagħna, ħaniprovaw inħarsu li aspetti differenti ta' kif il-politika kulturali għandha importanza, għandha tifsira f'aspetti differenti tas-soċjetà tagħna, mill-ambjent, sal-edukazzjoni, sal-riċerka u sa anke affarijiet u aspetti iktar popolari tal-ħajja tagħna. Fl-ewwel programm ħankun qed niltaqgħu mal-kuratriċi Maren Richter. So Maren, welcome to the program. I'm very glad to have been able to sort of bring you into the studios of Campus FM during one of your visits to Malta, which maybe are not very frequent, but they are quite, because as also listeners will get to know during the program, your relationship with Malta in the field of contemporary art curatorship has extended now a few years, and you've kept that up, and also I guess in this particular period of COVID-19, with its highs and lows and openings and closings, it's even sort of more of a feat to manage to travel from Vienna or wherever you are at a certain point in time to travel to Malta. So thank you in a double measure, so to speak.
Feeling very delighted to get invited from
As you know, Israel and our listeners are getting to know now during this series, I'm trying to look at sort of those touch points where cultural policy starts practicing and trying to set guidelines and trying to set certain things in motion in the cultural field and in the arts field. But maybe more interestingly, where it ends, where somehow cultural policy sometimes seems to run out of steam and run out of relevance sometimes because other things take over. Different people during this series have talked about how sometimes it's more a matter of money, how to finance your projects, or how to be relevant almost outside the field of art. Somehow you've got to tick some boxes and either practice socially oriented programs or education, even within the environment of the university. We're obviously very, very conscious about that, how somehow there's an educational overriding principle, and culture and the arts sometimes tend to act as a medium to something else. They have a function, but talk, for example, of art for art's sake, it's almost sort of something to be, I don't know, taken as a joke almost. How do you practice just art for art? What does it mean? You've got to come up with so much more to justify a project. And I know in your 25-year experience of contemporary arts, curatorship, networking, various work you've done all over the world, you have come across this. So maybe starting a bit from the end, I don't know, if I have to say it's of cultural policy and its relevance, mm-hmm. Is there still any within your practice?
Relevant. Well, I mean, you mentioned COVID-19, right? And I think this is quite interesting phenomenon, you know, which happened, first of all, to all of us globally. And I'm not sure, I followed that a bit in Malta, but like in Austria, for example, you know, there was something very simple, you know, when all of a sudden everybody had to sit at home, you know, and the governments are worried about businesses, you know, they would get some fund and you know, support, and artists and culture didn't, you know. And I think it was a bit similar in Malta, and that's quite interesting. All of a sudden there was a big debate on, you know, the cultural and cultural political relevance, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm, of arts. And I found that quite interesting because it was a very general discussion, you know, what is art good for, mm-hmm. you know, and
what's its what point?
What's its point exactly? And you were mentioning, you know, like art just for the sake of art, you know, which used to be like for centuries, right? Art historically speaking, and then all of a sudden, it was a kind of how to say emancipation, you know, like it was like democratized, no?
Yes.
In the sense that everybody should be able to experience art and culture.
Yes. So
and
moving I think away from the maybe classical or romantic idea.
Exactly,
of art,
exactly.
And
also like the elitary idea
of
art and culture. And I think with music that worked really well, you know, also with theater, it's almost like pop culture, no? We grew up with music, for example.
Yes.
So I'm coming from a field which is visual arts.
Yes.
And then it's getting a bit more complicated. So I would say I dedicated my curatorial practice from the very beginning on, and that was 25 years ago, with the idea, you know, how can you make art accessible to anybody?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a very big thing. But
yes.
You know, it's like how would it communicate? Because
yes.
I think contemporary art has so much to say.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were saying, like conceptual art, you know, which was not just the painting on the wall and the sculpture somewhere in public space, thought a lot about this idea, you know, whether it's politics, whether it's whatever kind of social issues, which are actually anybody's issues, no? So for me it was actually boring, let's say, to work in a museum or you know, like in the White Cube. So I was very much fascinated to find tools, you know, and to find practices where you can involve the people
yes.
already in the process, not only, you know, then there is the artwork and you try to explain somebody, okay, that's what the artist meant and that's conceptual like this, but
it.
Also like this process, and I think a lot of artworks are at the moment process oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So this was always much, much more interesting. And then, of course, you come very soon already into cultural policy, no? It's like, who has the right, you know, to access what, you know, under what conditions?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to question that all the time. And I'm just coming from the Maritime Museum. I had a meeting with Liam Gauci, and he brought it very much to the point as well. First of all, it's everything is always negotiable, you know.
Mm.
You have to, it's nothing given.
No, so
an,
red lines,
an artwork is not given, history is not given
mm-hmm.
either,
mm-hmm.
no? It's something you have a completely different point of view than I have. And I think the most relevant when we talk about anything, and this is whether it's academia or community, the question is, where do we give people the platform to exchange this knowledge? You know, like, and I think this is what really interests me, to create a possibility so that a fisherman can share his stories on an equal level with a professor from university, for example. Yes.
But somehow what you're saying, even before you mentioned the key word access, which has become in the last 10, 20 years almost overused in the field of policy guidelines.
Right.
But sometimes even within more recent policy exercises, access is still, you can get the feeling that access in the mind of policymakers or the texts that they produce or even the initiatives that they fund is a bit one-sided. It's like we have the knowledge, whoever the we is, the institution, the agency, the museum. However, we are sort of public, but they may also be private. Somehow, because it's the times, it's the democratic bent, as you said, over the past few years. Although coming into the studio, you mentioned how Vienna this year celebrates the centenary of sort of being social and democratic and red and being very, very open. So it's a long story.
Yeah.
But traditionally, let me say that there is the feeling that somehow give access to someone else. So there is someone who has, someone who hasn't, and you give them the opportunity. But the way you're talking about this platform of exchange, this environment of exchange, which reminds me of a term Paul Sant'Cassia had termed for the early phase of the capital of culture in Malta, which we have both been involved in, is more egalitarian in a way. It's not because the museum curator has the works, then somehow they are kind, benevolent, and therefore they will sort of in a way lower themselves to the people. It's something different about.
Yeah.
And maybe there's the challenge.
Yeah. No, I think you described it quite nicely, to say exactly like, we are the museum and we kindly open ourselves to go a bit lower, have a more simple language and whatever. This, of course, this is also important to make the academic knowledge accessible, right? And find ways, you know, how you would invite the general public, you know, to also understand what kind of academic researches are. But what I'm really quite interested is like to destabilize a bit the hierarchy of knowledge. And I think throughout the last almost century, you know, is like that the better you're educated, whatever, the better you are, right? In a way. But I think through all these crises we had to face, like in the last decades, the ecological crisis, for example, we also all of a sudden we have to actually acknowledge indigenous knowledge, you know, local knowledge, the simplicity of surviving somewhere. And I think this is equally important, and this is what I'm quite interested in. And therefore, I strongly believe in the horizontal line of knowledge, and I think this is for me at least in the project I'm doing extremely fruitful. You know, when you go to a farmer, and for example, we had this project in a very remote region in Austria, and we talked about climate change, where scientists sat on the table with farmers, simple people, and they explain how they measure climate change. Very simple, you know. I mean, there is the meadows, and all of a sudden there's more stones coming, you know, and there's things where the science, oh, wow, you know, I wasn't aware of that. And I think this is extremely important, and also like when we talk about history, for example, no, we have this representative history, the grand narrative, you know. But there is, I mean, history is the history of the many, no? I mean, Malta specifically, you know, it was colonized. Austria the same, we were the colonizers, no? When we talk about Hungary, we know the story from the empire, you know, going into...
the
But no, I mean, there's always many, many sides, you know, and I think we really have to fundamentally acknowledge that. We don't go further if we just, you know, this kind of system of linear growth, and we have to be faster, we have to be better, we know, we have to perfectionize ourselves in whatever, you know, to make the economy grow and anything, you know. I think we have to step back, and in that sense, COVID-19, I mean, I'm not saying it was a funny period, but I think what we hopefully learn from that is like to look around us, you know. I mean, I look on this table, I see two microphones, I see two bottles of water, and I want to know more about that. I'm not panicking what's happening outside the store, you know, like I hear some noise outside. It's this the beauty of looking into my neighboring whatever, you know.
Din tisema u l-program il-politika kulturali miħaj Karsten Xwirab u minn ġumma l-ġumma minn program għal-program kemm fil-bidu u fil-eluq tal-program kif ukoll fil-sfond ta' din il-pawza ħankunu nisimgħu sensiela ta' traċċi mill-Under Fokan Group mis-CD tal-2007 Swing alla Turk. The way you're describing it is almost looking at the counterpoint, so to speak, so the space is in between, because there's so much, which is not a vacuum, and there isn't a vacuum.
Exactly.
So
it is something, it's not nothing.
And when you mentioned the fishermen before, automatically it reminded me of part of your curated work during the Capital of Culture year, dealing with sort of much of the life of the harbor, of sea life, traditional music, traditional ways of communicating one with the other, specifically that project where you had the Anneia communicate across the harbor between Manuel Island on the one hand and Valletta on the other, using almost basic rudimentary means, megaphones with no electronic amplification. But recalling what used to be done, but not only for the sake of, say, nostalgia, or, oh, this was sweet, let's do it together again. But there is then the, for want of a better word, in a way, the craft, the artistry of what you can bring to... you also mentioned a number of projects. I wonder whether also what you're working on now can make us imagine what and why this looking at the spaces in between makes you so passionate about this particular exercise.
Well, at the moment I'm working on a really amazing project, but I don't know when I'm able to be going there next time. I'm working in Namibia. There is going to be the very first biennial in Windhoek, the capital of Namibia, and it's dealing with public spaces there, and it's extremely touching and I mean, first of all, Namibia has a very sad history. You know, there was this big genocide by the Germans on the one hand, and then afterwards South Africa colonized Namibia, and it was apartheid. And apartheid worked very simple. You know, you just put the black people in one side of the city and the white, and the separation, no, of race, so to speak. And it's still existing up to now. People would have the same roots, the same routines, the same way how to experience the city, how to kind of move around, so to speak. So we are doing the biennial. I have like six keywords, you know, where I want to look at the city, which is roots and roots.
Oh, both, yeah.
Routines, rituals, rites, and riots.
Uh-huh.
So under these six keywords, we try to invite different communities, you know, to share their stories. And again, like I mentioned in the context of Malta, you know, the especially the post-colonial and the colonial times, you know, there's still so much oral history, which the stories of individuals, you know, which are not yet been heard, you know. I mean, of course, there's quite a lot of initiatives, and then there is a young group of students which we work together. It's amazing. It's like about decolonizing spaces. So, for example, we had this monument debate, like the global monument debate, which of course also happened there. You know, you would find basically the monuments of the colonizers. You know, actually not the colonizers. I mean, those who really killed people in a extremely traumatic way. So I think the fabric of the city needs to be completely revised, you know. It needs a fundamental kind of turn of like thinking, rethink.
Is it something to be achieved? Is that the goal, for example, of the biennial itself on its own, or is it a collaboration with urban planners, politicians,
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is what I find extremely important, and when I talk about these projects, it's never just like within the arts, so to speak, no? Because I really strongly believe, as we were discussing now, it needs to have some impact, you know? These art projects, which are not in a museum, which are really like inviting people, ideally have a kind of legacy, you know, like a long-term legacy. So, of course, yeah, we work with urban planners. We actually work with different departments of university, with activists, also like environmental activists. I mean, there's a huge issue of drought in southern Africa at the moment, or for quite a while already. I mean, there's hardly rain. It's like really getting drier and drier, which is really bad, because actually they had already two times a state of emergency in the last years, so it's a fundamental problem. And again, this is interesting, you know, it's about the local knowledge is so important in order to survive, you know. I mean, you can invest as a government, you can invest a lot, but again, it's like, okay, is there some local knowledge where people used to survive really through simple mechanisms, no? And so improvisation will be also a important tool for us, because improvisation is really something very important in Namibia, but we try also to put it like in the academic, debates, you know, like how improvisation design, you know, social design can become a really important tool. So we have all different kind of collaborators in the city of Windhoek, and we try to open it for the moment, and then at some point, you know, we have to make a program out of it. I would say this is, I see the biennial, like the first biennial, is rather like a moment, you know, of pausing, and then the next biennial should go a next step, you know.
Even on a local level, I remember you being part of or leading workshops and processes, which in a way encouraged this improvisation, also sort of in a way making do with what you've got, and then transferring that, distilling that into plans, programs, debates. But in a way, the way you describe this process of improvisation, that reminds me a bit of jazz musicians who may improvise, but not without a lot of prior knowledge, the sediment which lies there. But in a way, if you know your stuff, then you can improvise, because mentally, but also in your traditions, I think many of those six keywords that you mentioned regarding the Namibian biennial, ritual, roots, in both ways, sort of go deep into us.
Yeah.
So since we're nearing the end of our exchange, you did mention legacy as a way of looking forward and leaving something behind. And you mentioned that even in your work, you try also to be practical. I guess many people, maybe even our listeners amongst them, might feel that sort of biennials happen, and there are many of them, and with COVID some of them have suffered and might have to happen in different ways, but there are many of them which in a way repeat themselves. Is this something we just have to accept, that sort of things repeat themselves and maybe the change is not that clear, is not that incremental, or are there different ways of trying to really leave an impact?
I disagree with you a bit that they're like all the same. I think there is, I mean, a biennial in general is for sure, you know, it's also like a European capital of culture, is an economy of attention. I mean, like, the reason why a city would support a biennial, for sure, no, it's about tourism, whatever, bring people in. But I think most of these biennials, like, having those processes which I just described, you know, maybe the visitors may not see them, you know, they may not feel them, but the impacts, you know, are there. So I mean, except like Venice Biennale, we know this is the big, that's the big spectacle, yes, in a way, no? But those city biennials I'm talking about, I wouldn't say they are how you describe it, you know, like, oh, that's another biennial.
Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of a distinction you're making between maybe the ones. You mentioned Venice, but there are others as well, grabbing the headlines, stars,
exactly,
red
exactly.
carpets,
yeah.
Which in a way have to live up to those expectations now, almost having to all the time shine brighter. And then there are others, which maybe are less glamorous.
They are completely unglamorous.
But more impactful.
Most of them have very little money as well. So,
Maureen, thank you very much for this exchange. It was very, very interesting.
Thank you for inviting me.